There are, of course, any number of mysteries about Stonehenge stuck out there in the Salisbury Plain. Those who visit it are often a bit disappointed in that it's not quite as grand as they anticipated, but it is marvellously enigmatic. But even more mysterious is what's going on with Stonehenge. For some reason, across the world, people are building replicas and sculptures of this ancient monument, and so I am not alone. From Slovenia to Spain to Thailand, and even here in Australia, I have some competition. What is it about Stonehenge that prompts people to do this? Now, to find out more, we're joined by Nancy Wisser, who runs Clonehenge. It's a project dedicated to keeping track of all the Stonehenge replicas in the world. And I'm delighted to say that Nancy's online from Pennsylvania. Welcome to the Little Wireless Program, Nancy.
Thank you. Hello, Philip. I would like to say I read up a little about you, and it's an honor to speak with you.
Well, I'm a sort of an ancient monument too, you see. So I have some affinity. Look, worldwide, there is about 100 permanent ones. I didn't know that, Nancy.
That's true, and most people don't realize it. And depending on your definition of Stonehenge replica, there are quite a few more than that. It's funny. The most interesting thing to me is that Stonehenge replicas, even though they're all replicas of the same thing, are wildly divergent, very different from each other.
I vaguely remember seeing a wonderful sort of, an echo of Stonehenge made with motor cars. Do you know that about that
yes.
one?
Yes. Well, which one?
So there's a few of those.
There's one in Nebraska that's probably the most famous one. And then just recently one appeared, I'm going to say Korea. And there have been others. There was one in Canada for a while. And for the Olympics, there was a small one built in London.
So there's a spectrum of accuracy, isn't there, in Stonehenge replicas, from full size and very careful reproductions to little garden varieties.
That's right. And then, of course, they're the ones made with celery or something, which are lots more, less accurate. But yes, people notice different things about Stonehenge, depending on who they are. It's like a Rorschach blot. so that a scientist will see this very precise kind of astronomical observatory and make something with very straight lines, whereas an artist will see it as a sculpture and try to imitate the roughness of the stones.
In introducing the program tonight, I was talking about my efforts to build a Stonehenge on the farm and how it's under mouse attack because we're having a huge mouse plague in Australia. But you point out that there are actually Stonehenges made out of cheese. God, they'd be popular.
Yes. Any conceivable material, especially if it's roughly rectangular, eventually there's a Stonehenge. I mean, sometimes I just, to find new ones, people don't usually send them to me. I do searches to find them. And I can almost count on if a material is sometimes in a rectangle that there will be a Stonehenge of it. So you can just Google Stonehenge plus whatever it is. I just found one made of pickled pork made in China yesterday.
Well, I'm looking at photos from your excellent efforts, and I'm looking at one of your personal favorites, which has to be one of the funniest, a Stonehenge street sculpture that detects and speaks to visitors.
Yes, how wonderful. I said maybe English Heritage should try that if they want to. Of course, they don't really need to drum up interest anymore. But yes, I mean, you walk up to it, it detects you and starts speaking to you. I think that's on some level brilliant.
But it's also very voluptuous and white and curvy. It's quite seductive.
Oh, I didn't see it that way. I saw it more as kind of a larval Stonehenge from which an adult Stonehenge would eventually emerge.
And then there's a very, very serious one in Spain on a bluff, which is a memorial to people killed during Franco's time.
Oh, you have become aware of some of my favorites. Yes, that's a beautiful thing. And it has a poem on it dedicated to the people lost to the regime. And it stands on a bluff, as you said, and they have red paint dripping on it. It's a very moving monument, and it just goes to show the wide spectrum that Stonehenge replicas represent to people, from the sublime to the ridiculous.
But you point out that there's other monuments to people who were victims of war.
That's right.
That Stonehenge is often recruited for that purpose.
Yes, there's for a long time there was a mistaken idea that human sacrifice took place at Stonehenge. It was very Victorian, I think, romantic. There's a slab there that when it gets a puddle on it, a kind of red microorganism grows in it, and people imagined it was blood, and so there was this whole thing. And that led to people using the monument to represent the sacrifice that governments made. There's one in Washington State that was really anti-war, although it's not usually described as that now, but it represented the way the government sacrificed the use of America to war.
That's the one in Washington State?
Yes, yes. Maryhill.
The oldest one in the U.S.
That's correct, yes.
Now,
I'm not used to talking to such informed people.
Look, apart from my efforts at the farm under mouse attack.
Yes, I'm very curious about this. You'll have to send me photos.
Tell me about what else is going on in Australia. I had no idea that there was a full-size replica in Esperance.
Oh, yes. Well, that's one of the most remarkable ones in the world. As a matter of fact, when I had the privilege to go to England and speak with some Stonehenge experts and ask them, what is your favorite Stonehenge replica? One of them cited that one in Esperance as being his favorite because the alignments apparently are perfect and they've gone to great lengths to make it really an excellent structure. I've heard Australian people who had been to England and seen the real one say that the real one was rubbish, that the Esperance one was much better.
Now, we're talking about a full-size replica, and it appears as the original would have looked around 2000 BC.
That's right, except the stones, of course, are very even. It's, you know, the history of that is that a man named Ross Smith, who apparently at the time was wealthy, commissioned to have those stones cut out of the quarry, but then he went bankrupt. I was following this from Clonehenge the whole time, and for a while those stones just sat in the quarry, and then the Beals eventually bought them and erected them on their farm. So they're sort of heroes to me.
I must say, Stonehenge, well, this one at Esperance, it looks sharp like a new set of teeth, whereas the one on the Salisbury Plain looks it looks like the teeth have gone off, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I don't think it was ever quite so sharp, as you say. I think the stones were largely rough, but it has certainly been affected by the thousands of years that have gone by. And people chipped pieces off it. People broke up the stones and hauled them off to build houses. The one, it has taken a lot of abuse, that one out there, and it's amazing it's still there. I think,
That always happens with monoliths. All the wonderful white limestone that coated the Great Pyramid, for instance, was looted to build, the mosques in Cairo. Now, I have to tell you that my executive producer has just Googled and she's found a Stonehenge made out of Tim Tams. This is a very Australian building material. But you see, your appearance on the program is causing widespread excitement. How did you get into this? I know that you were involved in preserving Native American Indian stonework.
That's right. And someone ask, the question that began to be asked was, would it be better for the Native American stonework to be known, or would it be better to keep it hidden, which would keep it safer? Because if it's known, there's some people who hate Native Americans or that want to find artifacts, and they might take them apart or destroy them purposely. But if they weren't known, they might be accidentally destroyed in the creation of, you know, development. So they asked me to find out from people in England, and I went on and found a website called the Megalithic Portal, where I found, I have to say, some kindred spirits. And we began joking about Stonehenge and how everything is sort of the Stonehenge of Siberia, or the Stonehenge of Africa, or the Stonehenge of Brazil, or whatever. And we began sending each other, as a joke, any Stonehenge we found on the internet. And he lost interest, the person I was sending him to, but I began to say, this is funny. And that's how it all started.
We should point out, of course, that there are henges all over the UK. I've visited quite a lot in Scotland, for example. Now, are you a druid?
No, I'm afraid not. And the big disappointment for a lot of people is, as I'm sure you know, druids had nothing whatsoever to do with Stonehenge.
Now, I love the way you talk about this. Scientists built them as astronomical observatories. Artists built them as sculptures. Curiously, few were made by pagans. Large ones, small ones, different proportions, with different ideas. And you have been dazzled, haven't you, by the number and the diversity.
That's right. And by the human spirit that's behind them. I think for people, Stonehenge is a symbol a lot of times of, you know, the very deep things, timelessness and death and rebirth and mystery. And the wonderful thing about people is they can look at that and then do something playful with it. And for me, I think that's what's kept me at it. Is again and again, I see human ingenuity, like the car one you mentioned in Nebraska, or I see playfulness where people are sitting at a table eating chips and they suddenly build a Stonehenge. I see a wonderful side of human nature at a time in history when sometimes it's hard to remember there is a wonderful side.
Well said. Now, tell me briefly the rules of henginess.
Okay. Well, that the story behind that is apparently there are hundreds and hundreds of modern stone circles around the world, and people wanted me to post them. And I was only doing things that were purposely replicas of Stonehenge. So all the other circles, although I love them, I couldn't include. And people got, this is the internet, people got testy with me. They got angry with me because I wouldn't post their wonderful stone circle. So I made the rules of henginess based on an old website called Cute Overload, where she had the rules of cuteness. So that was a fun thing I did early on, and it really helped me to kind of ward off a lot of anger from people.
You've also got a rating system, Nancy.
A what?
A rating system.
Oh, yes, yes.
You give it, I know it's nothing to do with druids, but you give it a druid rating out of 10.
That's right, that's right. And then the only thing that could get 10 is Stonehenge, but it's not a replica, so it doesn't count.
Do you award them often?
I don't so much anymore. Back in the days, Philip, when people had time to actually read a blog post, I posted more on the blog, but people have told me they just don't have time to go to a blog and read the posts. So now mostly I do really short things on Facebook and Twitter, and I've started one on Instagram where I post a small percentage of the Stonehenges that I find each day.
I don't know if you discovered this, but on the program, when I have a guest who I think is exceptionally interesting, there is an award. And it's not, you know, it's not a Stonehenge sort of award, but it's called the Koala Stamp. There's no physical manifestation, but you have just won a koala stamp for your wonderful efforts on behalf of henges everywhere.
Well, thank you very much. I'm honored. I will treasure it.
Nancy, thank you for that. Nancy Wisser from Clonehenge. How do we contact Clonehenge?
The best way is on Twitter or Facebook. Just look up Clonehenge. The Facebook group is called Clonehenge Stonehenge Replicas Unleashed.
Good on you, Nancy. Nancy Wisser, busy keeping track of all the Stonehenge replicas and parodies around the world.